This week on Making Contact.
No decent Iranian would want his country to be attacked by a foreign force. And we've showed that in our country. It's just unfortunately a perspective that is wrong and is being inserted in Washington by some people. But I don't think no one would accept it.
Is Iran developing nuclear weapons? And should the U.S. launch a military strike? In this firsthand report, we hear from high-ranking officials and ordinary Iranians about U.S. threats and about what the election of a new president will mean for the people of Iran. Independent radio producer Reese Ehrlich visited Iran and brings you this special edition of Making Contact. I'm Tina Rubio, your host this week on Making Contact, a program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information.
We're walking through one of the most highly guarded locations in Tehran, a place where ordinary Iranians never go. It's the compound where Ayatollah Khomeini once ruled, and today it houses some of the country's top officials.
This is the famous balcony which we're just about to go and see. This is the place for the first time Ayatollah Khomeini called America a great Satan. This is the place. That's how everything started. This is the place.
In 1978, a popular revolution overthrew the hated dictatorship of the Shah of Iran. The following year, a group of students took over the U.S. Embassy, which helped Ayatollah Khomeini consolidate his power and impose a strict Islamic political system. Hassan Khomeini is the grandson of Ayatollah Khomeini and heads the influential Khomeini Foundation. While he concedes that U.S.-Iranian relations have been bad for a long time, he blames President George W. Bush for making things worse. After all, it was Bush who referred to Iran as part of the axis of evil.
The first thing that comes to mind is the axis of evil thing. The first thing is to recognize the Iranian government as an independent government. This is the first step. And the American public opinion should force the American government, to change its viewpoint in that regard.
These days, the Bush administration claims that Iran is a major sponsor of terrorism and is intent on building nuclear weapons. But this view is disputed by most countries around the world. I asked Khomeini if the U.S. is using those issues as an excuse to build up public support at home for a military strike.
America is using it as an excuse, but I don't know. I'm not sure about its intentions and what the Bush administration has in mind to do that. And it will be clear in the future. And I don't believe that America is capable enough to attack Iran. It cannot do that. It's impossible. The American public opinion, as well as what America is facing in Iraq, and also the entire situation in the world, doesn't allow America to do that.
Iran's hardliners, who favor a right-wing interpretation of Islam, continue their strong opposition to the U.S. At Friday prayers in Tehran, hardline clerics lead the faithful in a familiar chant.
That's America, that's America, that's America.
In his sermon, Ayatollah Janati, a top Iranian government official, condemns the U.S. for threatening to launch airstrikes against Iran's nuclear facilities.
We hope that these actions by our people will push America to death and to its eternal end. And the eternal hell that it's created for itself. America is on the decline. It's going to fall. Every day, America's international credibility is going down, and it's in decline. It's about to fall. This policy that they're pursuing is a policy of aggression and barbarism, and today's mankind will not tolerate this kind of policies.
At a hotel coffee shop, Hamid Reza Asafi, Iran's deputy foreign minister, says the Bush administration's criticisms of nuclear weapons ring hollow.
We cannot trust American argument while they are supporting Israel, while they are keeping silent to other violation of international laws. The second point, American is increasingly stockpiling their arms, military arms. How they can criticize others for having that when they are doing that? If Americans are honest, they should start destroying their nuclear weapons. Then the people listen to them.
Asafi claims that Iran has no intention of developing nuclear weapons.
That is not in our defense doctrine. We don't believe in that. We think that is very fatal. That will lead to arm race in the region. Therefore, we are not looking for that, and we are not hiding that.
It's not surprising that Iran's government officials and hardline clerics denounce U.S. policy. But reformists, including moderates and progressives who want to maintain the Islamic State, express surprisingly similar views. But they also want greater political freedom and democracy. Both hardliners and reformists share a common assumption that Iran has the right to develop nuclear power. Some individual reformers, like this political science student, even say the country has a right to build atomic bombs.
Ideally, it would be good to have access to nuclear weapons. Other countries have access to them, like Pakistan and Israel. Why shouldn't we? We would not confront the world or use them in a bad way.
In dozens of interviews around the nation's capital, not a single Iranian objected to the concept of Iran developing nuclear power. Here at the ancient Tehran Bazaar, thousands of shoppers buy everything from food to household appliances. A carpet shop owner named Mehdi says he knows of no dangers from producing nuclear power.
If it's going to be dangerous, it's dangerous for everyone in the world, not just for the Iranian people.
Ermidas Bavand, a law professor and former Iranian diplomat, says the vast majority of Iranians see developing nuclear power as an issue of national pride. He finds it ironic that the Bush administration questions why Iran, with all its oil and natural gas, would want to develop nuclear power. He points out that 25 years ago, during the dictatorship of the Shah, the U.S. and Europe strongly encouraged Iran to develop a nuclear energy program.
We have three treaty arrangements, first and foremost with Germany, with regard to the Bushehr nuclear site. Then we have a treaty arrangement with France, already, and also with the United States. They were supposed to cooperate with the government of Iran for the establishment of 12 nuclear sites. But after the revolution, they abrogated all those treaty arrangements. And they also condemned access to the nuclear technology.
Bavand says unlike people in the U.S. and Europe, Iranians don't debate the potential environmental dangers associated with mining, processing, and using nuclear fuel to generate electricity.
The question has not been tackled properly within the Iranian decision-making. That particular issue has not been subject to a special consideration.
In an interview, former President Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani says Iran is concerned about maintaining nuclear safety.
We have a contract with the Russians to take the waste back to Russia. For future functions, we have the program to have the fuel recycled in Iran.
Rafsanjani says Iran will not develop nuclear weapons because they run counter to Islamic teachings.
In our thoughts, actually Islamic thoughts, we are strongly of the idea that these kind of weapons, nuclear weapons, are against any kind of humanitarian act and it should be removed and the whole world should be a nuclear-free zone, the whole world. And we are making all our efforts in order to dismantle all these nuclear weapons in all countries around the world and make the world a safe place. And naturally, we would not go to military use of nuclear power as well.
So that means there's no nuclear weapons would be developed in Iran.
یعنی هیچ سلاح هستی در ایران هیچ وقت تولید نخواهد.
هیچ وقت نخواهد.
Never, never, ever.
But such assurances are dismissed out of hand by the U.S. The Bush administration points out that Iran hid some of its nuclear programs during the 1980s. The Iranians now admit doing so, but say they feared the U.S. would cut them off from technology needed for nuclear power. Mohammad Al-Baradei, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, says Iran doesn't pose any immediate threat. He is the same official who correctly pointed out that Iraq had no nuclear weapons prior to the 2003 invasion of that country by the U.S.
This is a matter of concern, clearly, to us, but it is not the imminent threat that we are facing in the case of North Korea. We have time for diplomacy. We have time for dialogue.
Elberde notes that three major European governments are currently negotiating to allow Iran to develop nuclear power for peaceful purposes, while installing safeguards against using the fuel for nuclear weapons.
What we need is to get all the parties together, to put all their grievances on the table, and to try to agree on a package that is perceived by all of them to be fair and equitable. But we also need Iran to assure the international community that their program, you know, is really to produce electricity and not for any military application.
The Bush administration has asserted the right to take military action if negotiations fail. While a full-scale invasion and occupation seems unlikely, the U.S. does have contingency plans for an air raid or missile strike on suspected nuclear facilities. Ordinary Iranians, even those opposed to the hardline government, get angry when they hear about a possible attack by the U.S. A street musician entertains customers in front of this posh cafe in northern Tehran. Customers here are wealthy and educated. This man, who describes himself as a fierce government opponent, says he doubts the U.S. will launch missile attacks on his country's nuclear facilities, let alone invade.
I think political ramifications and repercussions of attacking Iran is just so great that I don't believe not George Bush's administration or any other American administration would undertake. If anything, I see the threat from Israel. Israelis may do that.
He's referring to Israel's 1981 air attack that destroyed an Iraqi nuclear power plant. Many Iranians worry that the U.S. might give Israel the green light for a similar attack on Iran. But he says, should anyone take military action, the country would unite. He says, a U.S. or Israeli attack would discredit reformers and give hardliners even greater power.
No decent Iranian would want his country to be attacked by a foreign force. And we've showed that in our country. It's just unfortunately a perspective that is wrong and is being inserted in Washington by some people. But I don't think no one would accept it.
So while the U.S. is ratcheting up tensions with Iran, the Iranian people remain strongly opposed to Bush's policies. I asked Deputy Foreign Minister Asafi, what would it take to warm up U.S.-Iranian relations?
I believe the Americans should really change their attitude, their approach vis-a-vis Iran. America is a big country, important country, superpower. It is better for us to have a good relation with them. But that is up to American to change their attitude.
So far, there are few indications that the Bush administration will significantly change its policies towards Iran. While worried about U.S. actions, most Iranians are far more concerned about the domestic situation, particularly the recent presidential elections.
We'll have more about Iran in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information, or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org.
Last June, in this working-class neighborhood of Tehran, people waited patiently for their chance to vote in the presidential election. The Bush administration denounced the lack of democracy in Iran, but on some levels, Iran's voting procedures are far more democratic than those in the U.S. There's no registration system, so citizens above the age of 15 may vote by presenting their ID cards. Voter turnout is consistently higher in Iran than in the U.S. 16-year-old Mariam Majid is voting for the first time.
I think Mr. Ahmadinejad is the best. He's the mayor, Ahmadinejad. I've watched TV and I've seen some magazines. And the campaign of each president, I mean, that's been interesting for me.
Mahmoud Ahmadinejad won the June presidential election running as a populist. He's a former mayor of Tehran and was also the head of the feared right-wing militia. But his simple lifestyle appealed to working-class Iranians facing 17% unemployment and stagnant incomes. Hassan Pushnagar, a leading pollster in Tehran, says conservative populist campaigns appealed to the working class.
People won't accept the gap between rich and poor, between have and have-nots, despite economic development. People's most important needs are jobs, not simply political freedom.
20-year-old Reza is a political science student at the University of Tehran.
He says, although I'm studying political science, but I have no hopes for my future, and I don't think that I'll get the chance to work in any governmental organization. And he mentioned nepotism and how people who want to work have to, they're ideologically questioned, you know, and there's no hope.
Rafsanjani, the presidential candidate who placed second in a field of seven, also said during his campaign that the economy needed big improvements. He says young voters supported his plans to create jobs.
We are strongly of the opinion that if we are going to attract the running around kind of investments inside Iran and the foreign investments, for sure we may have lots of job employments. And everything is ready for attracting and absorbing such investment in Iran.
Back in the Tehran bazaar, many people said they chose not to vote at all. Some are cynical about the general lack of democracy. For example, this year, more than 1,000 candidates were disqualified by the Guardian Council, an unelected and all-powerful body of clerics. Young people played a decisive role in electing reformist President Mohammad Khatami in 1997 and 2001. Many were severely disappointed, however, by Khatami's failure to deliver significant change. 19-year-old Army Private Amir Hossein says he and his fellow soldiers are fed up with politics.
We don't talk about elections that much. It's a chaotic country. They do nothing for us, the young people, and it doesn't make any difference who wins the elections.
That sentiment is even stronger among intellectuals and the wealthy. Back in the Espresso Cafe, a woman named Salome, who identifies as a lesbian, says ex-president and reformist Khatami failed to deliver on promises of greater personal freedom.
The first thing and most important thing is privacy. She's talking about privacy, to feel free at your own home, not to be worried about someone hitting on you or someone coming in and, you know, beating you when you have some friends over, for instance. Or even traveling, she says.
By the way, I should mention that we live together without our family. We live alone. And that even caused a lot of problems for the neighborhoods. They think, why they are not living with their families? Why? How come they are alone?
Because you're two single women.
Yeah.
Salome says she and her friends boycotted the election.
She's saying she doesn't trust them.
She doesn't believe in the regime, and she thinks that it's not her choice because it's a mandatory regime and it's driven by force. So she doesn't trust. She neither believes in it nor trusts it. Everybody she knows thinks the same way.
While the pro-boycott sentiment was strong among Iran's upper classes, the overall voter turnout was as high as 65%, according to official figures. That's somewhat down from past presidential elections, but the boycott clearly had little impact. Those progressives and reformists who did vote rallied behind presidential candidate Dr. Mostafa Moin, a former minister of education. Thousands of teens and 20-somethings, their faces painted with the Iranian flag, are gathered at a campaign rally inside a soccer stadium. They call themselves reformers, but in most cases, that doesn't mean they want to overthrow the Islamic Republic and establish a secular, Western-style government. Reza, a political science student, typifies the views of many young reformists who want to see changes, but within the Islamic system.
90% of the Iranians are Muslims, and we are a Muslim country. If we're talking about the foreign policy, yes, I agree with you. Maybe it's better to have
religion and politics separated. But when it comes to national issues, I don't believe that's a very good idea. We believe in Islam, and Islam is a religion which doesn't only focus on personal matters. It's a religion which encompasses both social and personal issues. So all answers are included in Islam.
Supporters of Dr. Moeen understand they're facing a prolonged battle because the conservatives have so much power in Iran. Hardliners now control the parliament, judiciary, presidency, armed forces, and security services. 25-year-old Ruzbeh Lehlavi says progressives and reformists must build a long-term movement to have any chance of success.
We have to build a movement for change. It might take 50 or 60 years. We may not live in good conditions, and maybe even our children won't. But their children will.
Within the reformist trend in Iran, there's an activist component that's demanding more far-reaching changes. Women's rights activists hold a peaceful demonstration in front of Tehran University one day, but it's quickly disrupted by police and plainclothes security officers. These demonstrators raise fundamental questions about the regime.
There's no freedom of speech whenever we want to talk. How come we can't have any women as a presidential candidate?
There is no democracy for people of Iran. We don't want this regime. This regime is absolutely a dictator, and we want it to change.
Political prisoners should be freed.
This girl explains that she was beaten by the police before she could even reach the demonstration.
She was crossing the street and she was stuck behind a bus. Then she was beaten up and because she didn't follow the rules, and they tried to stop her from crossing the street, and she was trying to go away. They hit her on her legs.
For the moment, such demonstrations don't attract large crowds, in part because of violent government crackdowns. The clerical rulers have also generated a cynicism towards politics in general, while allowing improved privileges for some. After the election of reformist President Khatami, Iranians enjoyed greater degrees of freedom. Dress codes for women became less strict. Wealthy Iranians could set up illegal satellite dishes and buy smuggled alcohol and pirated DVDs of Western films. Some of these goods filtered down to middle-income Iranians. A street musician serenades shoppers here at the bazaar. 26-year-old Moshtabar says bootleg movies and CDs are easily available.
It's all over. I mean, you can find it everywhere.
Moshtabar says many Iranian young people are obsessed with Hollywood movie stars. Then, in one of those moments that you usually only see in the movies, Moshtabar notices that Sean Penn, the actor, is standing right next to him. The actor is visiting Tehran to write an article for the San Francisco Chronicle.
I was going to say, what movies is he like?
He's going to see Interpreter.
They have it on
DVD. I know that you were married to Madonna.
So here is youthful Iran in all its complexities. The government bans Western films, but the entire country knows Sean Penn and Madonna. This kind of struggle between government-sanctioned conservative values and more liberal views also plays out at the family level. 15-year-old Michelle is visiting this upscale shopping mall in northern Tehran. Wealthy Iranians wander through stores stocked with imported cosmetics, Italian designer clothes, and high-tech sound systems. Both Michelle and her mom have lived in the U.S. before, but now reside in Tehran.
When we were in the U.S., you know, in a mall, I would let them go by themselves and I come back and pick them up. But here they're not allowed to because, I don't know, the young people, there's too much drug going on.
I think they're really much exaggerating it. Yeah, it's really good to be protective, but not this much.
A few years ago, Michelle and her mom would have worn long head-to-toe coverings called chadors. But in a sign of liberalization, it's acceptable now to wear a manteau, a less encompassing covering.
I'm wearing like sandals, jean, and green Rufush, I don't know what they call it.
Manto.
Yeah, it's like a long shirt almost outside your
Yeah, when we bought it, it was up to here, but she had me shorten it.
See, now in the U.S., the girls want their skirts shortened. Yes. So it's the same principle, right?
Yeah.
Would you go to a party with friends? Is that
yes, of course.
Only girls.
No. these days, maybe, no, maybe brothers of a couple of girls, but no. No, not like that. We go to parties, like there are boys, we hang out.
Iranians remember that some years back, police and right-wing militia would bust up house parties if there were unmarried young people together or if alcohol was being served. Crackdowns have been rare in recent years. However, some Iranians now fear their new hardline president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, will bring back that kind of repression.
In the U.S., I really go lots of places alone. And
why not in Iran?
Because, like, if a police comes and tells me that we have to go, I can't do anything.
They
like,
take them, you know, from a party if they find out that the girls and boys, they come and they take them somewhere and you don't know where they are.
In the late 1990s, teens like Michelle participated in political rallies demanding greater liberalization of the Islamic Republic. Today, many wealthy young people are absorbed in consumerism. Michelle recently bought a new cell phone that cost $1,100, including activation. She even has her own very teenage ringtone.
Hello? Yossi?
You don't have to.
Michelle says she and her friends in Tehran concentrate on shopping and other personal matters, not politics.
They don't even know about politics a lot. Like me, I don't know anything. They really want this to change, but they can't do anything because they're really afraid.
Critics say Iran's rulers have cracked down on political dissent, while at the same time allowing the wealthy elite greater economic choices. Economist Feriboz Raizdana says the clerical establishment indirectly encourages consumerism among Iran's wealthy young people. The ruling elite makes a lot of money from taxes charged on high-end consumer goods.
If they collect money for themselves, this time they realize that they have to give a part and a share to the upper-class youth. There are 5 or 10% of the society that they can buy those cars, and they are living in very huge and big and very luxury apartments. They can have bank accounts in European countries.
Raizdana says, however, that the government's policy has had the opposite effect on the less affluent. The gap between rich and poor is growing, and working-class Iranians can't afford food and housing, let alone expensive cars, luxury apartments, or $1,100 cell phones. Over the years, Iran's popular movements have ebbed and flowed. While many Iranians reject U.S. efforts to interfere in their country, they also remain committed to seeking significant change themselves. From Tehran, for Making Contact, I'm Reese Ehrlich.
That's it for this special edition of Making Contact, written and produced by Reese Ehrlich. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production funded primarily by generous gifts from people in the community. We are committed to providing a unique forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. For a cassette or CD copy of program number 3405, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Justin Beck and Pauline Bartoloni, associate producers, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, Esther Mania, outreach coordinator, Tom Evans, development associate, Emily Polk, production fellow, Megan Kaiser and Lawton Chan, production interns, and I'm your host and senior producer, Tina Rubio.